and welcome to the True Grit Podcast, where we believe that personal growth and helping each other solve important problems is the best way to make the world a better place. I'm your host, Craig Couch, and every week it's my job to interview top performers and unlock the secrets of their success so that you and I can apply some of their thought patterns, daily rituals, and strategies to our own missions. My next guest is Dr. Philip Shiro, president of Mastermind Leadership, a cutting-edge executive coaching team development. Dr. Shiro holds a PhD in organizational leadership from Regent University, as well as a master's from TCU. Helping others grow as leaders is Dr. Shiro's driving force. He brings two decades of leadership development and strategic planning expertise to some of the most well-known medium-sized finance, nonprofit, and construction companies in Texas. With a long track record of success in coaching existing and emerging leaders at the CEO, partner, and senior management levels, he's become known as one of the most dynamic and engaged leadership and strategic planning coaches in DFW. His national reputation is growing through his expert leadership training seminars, senior leadership retreat facilitation, strategic planning services, and a full line of job benchmarking products. Over the years, he's created a dynamic duo with his wife, Laura, who's working on her doctorate in quantitative behavior from Baylor. Philip has dedicated his life to developing leaders and is firing on all cylinders right here in Cowtown. Dr. Shiro, welcome to the True Grit Podcast.
Thank you, Craig. I'm so excited to be here with you today.
Yeah, well, I've been really looking forward to our conversation. And as an executive coach and a consultant, you have a really cool knowledge advantage over the typical entrepreneur because you get to see a wide variety of industries and teams and cultures, CEOs and founders, and all the challenges that surround the building a business. Before I get into all the business stuff, one of the things that I've learned is that you really love working with your wife. Tell us about Laura.
Laura is amazing. I know it's common to say you outkicked your coverage or you married up. But in our case, I think Laura and I really sharpen each other. Not every entrepreneur wants to or has the marriage dynamic to work with their spouse. But we love it. We get energized by that. We've worked together in Africa. We've worked together here in Fort Worth. I just feel like we complete each other. Her strengths are completely opposite from mine, and we're just much better together.
So you would probably, my guess is based on her doctorate studies, she's more of a data person and you're more of a people person. Is that a good assumption? Is that right?
Yeah, I think that would be a fair assessment. She's doing quantitative psychology, which is taking the people side, the drive and motivation and traits and styles, and she's combining that with data and analytics and measurement. I don't know a lot of people that can kind of straddle both worlds and do that well, but she does, and it's such an asset.
That's so cool. Well, my wife and I work together as well, not in my real estate business, but we have a digital marketing company that she's actually the CEO of, and I'm sort of the visionary behind it. And anyway, we spend a lot of time on her company and help grow in it. And it's really hard though, like on date night, like describe to me a date night for you guys. Like how do you... Like, give me a tip here. You and I discovered you and I've been married exactly the same. We were married the same year back in 1995. So we've both been married for 26 years. But yeah. I'm asking you for some advice here. How do you balance your relationship with the business side of what you guys do?
Yeah. So we've got a couple of boundaries, and Laura really helped us set some of those up. So 9 o'clock, we go upstairs and get ready for bed. And once once we head up the stairs, there is no more business discussion, no finance, no potentially stressful issues can get brought up at all, because we want to protect that time when we go into our bedroom and we're closing down the day. So that's one of our boundaries. Another is we take walks together. We may walk for an hour. We did that yesterday. And when we're on the walk, I ask permission. I'm like, hey, are you okay if I bring up a business topic? And yesterday she was like, yeah, I've got the energy for that. So we spent the whole hour talking about the business and vision and strategy. But other walks, she's like, no, let's not do business today. So kind of checking in and asking permission. And then date nights, both business and like parenting are off the table. Like those are just no-nos for date night. We don't do that. We schedule time on our calendar for she and I to meet about the business every week. In fact, we just had that hour this morning. Because if we don't schedule it, it creeps into everything.
Yeah, I think that's probably what happens to Jennifer and I. You know, she basically leads a tribe of thousands of women, literally, but it's a virtual business online, but it's not, it doesn't feel virtual. So it's all encompassing. And we find our business a lot of time just creeps into everything. And even though we do have leadership meetings that are scheduled, it's not just she and I. So that's a really good idea. That's a good boundary. And I like the permission thing. That's a good, that I've actually used that a couple of times. Like, is now a good time for us to discuss current sales? You know, like, because a lot of time the answer is hell no, it's not. Right. So it's a great tip for sure. Well, so in our pre-interview, you mentioned something I thought was really interesting. You said you told a brief version of a story about you in your earlier in your career, you making a deal with God. Will you kind of tell that story as we launch into our discussion?
Yes. So we were in Africa. This is probably about 2004, 2005. And the vision for launching a new university had just, you know, it dropped in my lap. I've been invited to take a leadership role in that. And I could see this amazing future of, you know, carving out of nothing, you know, in Africa, building a university to the glory of God. And it was going to be awesome. And I was fired up. And at that same time, my boys were 4 and 2. And I got James Dobson's book, Bringing Up Boys. And I thought, okay, yeah. I've got young boys. I'm a new dad. I need to figure this out on the front end. So I'm reading the book. And I read this story that James Dobson tells about himself, that he was a rebellious teenager, completely going off the rails. His dad was a super successful pastor, had a large church in a big city and a full year of speaking engagements booked out in advance. And, you know, one day James' mom called his dad and said, you know, Junior's been sent home by the principal and, you know, they're going to expel him. You got to get home and deal with your son. And when James's dad got home, he realized the gravity of what was about to happen, left the pastorate in the big city, moved out to the country, took a small church, canceled his speaking engagements, just basically took a hard 180 with his career to go be with his son and help his son make it. And of course, James is the son, and he's telling this story that because his dad made that investment in him, he did make it. And then focus on the family came, you know, out of James's life. And I read that story and I thought, wow, I just have a clue that what I'm doing could become an all-consuming sort of kingdom building, career building direction for me. And I'm concerned about, you know, could I get to that point that James' dad got to where my sons might be going off the rails. So I made the deal with God. I don't know if you're supposed to do this or not, but I was like, God, if I get to that point and I'm about to lose my family and I need to make a decision between them and my career or whatever I'm building, would you yank my chain? Like, would you remind me, would you make the decision for me if I can't see it or make it in the moment? Because I don't want to lose my family. That comes first. And, prayed the prayer, made the deal and then kind of forgot about it. And 8 years later, I got fired from being the president of the university. And it felt like such this deep betrayal by people I had known and worked with in some cases for 17 years. One of the guys that pulled the trigger to fire me was literally in my will as the guy that would keep my kids if something happened to me and Laura. I mean, that was the depth. And I was crushed by it. But in the middle of the grief and the agony, God kind of tapped me on the shoulder. He said, "Hey, you remember our deal?" And it reframed everything because then I realized this was not, I mean, yes, there was betrayal and hurt, a tremendous hurt, but I realized there was also a rescue that I had gotten so far overextended. I was working about 70 hours a week, building the university, earning a PhD, just hooked up an IV, feeding my blood into this university we were building. Everything was going into it. And my kids were teetering. That was the deal. And God held up his side.
Yeah. And I love those kind of deals. Those kind of deals take a lot of courage, really. Because typically, if you think about deals we make with God, being exchanges, like, "God, if you get me out of this pickle, I promise never to do it again," is different than God, "Hey, if I get too far down this hole here, yank my chain," as you said, and yank me. I mean, it was like you got, and what's amazing, it was with such close people, to your heart. What did that do to your, because you obviously had a major purpose. You had your IV hooked up to this university, building it overseas, with a very clear purpose, right? Your purpose, your identity, kind of the mark that you were planning on leaving on the world was eliminated.
Yeah.
Can you speak to that? What that was like?
Guttural doesn't describe it. I mean, that scene in Braveheart, where at the very end, where he's all stretched out and he's about to lose his life, and they literally like cut open his bowels and they're pulling them out, and you see the agony that he's going through. That's what it felt like. It felt like I had given everything for this, and I had a purpose, and it was just blown up. I mean, not a piece big enough to pick up and put together with another piece. I think my biggest struggle for the next 3 years was, what is my purpose? I mean, it was so crystal clear in Africa. I mean, it was just, I had obstacles and struggles and blood, sweat, and tears and all that, but I never woke up wondering what I was supposed to do that day. I never woke up wondering if it mattered. That was clear. And all of a sudden, it wasn't. And during that time, there was this day where I shouted at God and I banged my fist on my desk and I said, "Whenever you get ready to use me again, you'll know right where to find me. I'll be right here at the bottom of this pit you put me in." And I was literally shouting at the ceiling because it hurt so bad. And that night I was laying in bed. It's dark. Laura's gone to sleep. Tears running down my face. And all that anger had just sort of dissolved into just grief. And I'm grieving, and I called out to God again, not shouting this time, but it's like, "God, it's so dark. It's so dark. I can't see anything." And Craig, I heard God chuckle. Like, it was like he was laughing. Like, I was like, what? How can you laugh at a time like this? I'm pouring my heart out now. I'm just raw. How can you be laughing? He said, son, of course it's dark. I've got my hands over your eyes. And it just in a fraction of a second, I just had this whole scene downloaded in my head of like a dad standing behind an 8 to 10 year old boy with his hands wrapped around him and covering his eyes. And he's walking him through the house. And then they kind of get to the living room and he pulls his hands away. And there's a big bicycle with a red ribbon on it. And it's like, surprise. That whole scene just in a fraction of a second was in my head. And I was like, oh, it's dark because you don't want me to see right now, but you're guiding me. And there's something I'm going to see, but I'm not supposed to see it now. The darkness is not failure. It's not abandonment. You're actually closer. Your hands are literally on my face. That's how close you are. It felt like he was a million miles away and I was at the bottom of a pit. But no, he was right up against my back with his hands on my face leading me. But I was used to having the vision. I was used to being the visionary and seeing what was next and knowing the future, like dragging the future forcefully into the present and making it happen. And suddenly I couldn't see anything. It was just, yeah, completely reframed my experience.
Golly, what a beautiful story. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think it's really valuable. I think that people respond to that darkness a lot of different ways. And your response was really beautiful. And so in that 3-year dark spot that you found yourself in, I'm guessing you're back in the States. Describe, just to spend a couple of minutes describing what was actually going on financially. Yeah. What was your situation? I mean, because you were overseas. And now I'm guessing you didn't have a house. Like, what was going on in those 3 years, just physically?
So, we moved back to Fort Worth, and while we were in Africa, the whole housing crisis and home loan crisis happened in 08, 09, and they redid all the rules for how you borrow money to get a house. So when we came back, even though we had some savings, we had a down payment ready, we literally couldn't get a loan because we didn't meet the new ability to repay standards. And it was so frustrating to be like, I've got a family, I've got kids in high school, and I'm unable to buy a house. Like I'm 20 years into my career and a bank won't give me any money. That felt so like humiliating. And so we rented a house. I couldn't afford to buy cars. So I did buy an old car that I could drive around for work, but we borrowed my in-law's minivan for the next 3 years. So I'm literally like, how low can you get as an entrepreneur if you're borrowing a van from your in-laws? I was like, I'm like, you know, am I like moving back in with my parents? What's next? And so I'm trying to start a business. And at my first effort, I went into business with another consultant and my base pay was not enough to cover the rent. And I literally could, I had all these opportunities to talk to business leaders, but I couldn't close any sales. Like I had lunch after lunch, breakfast after breakfast, coffee after coffee. And these business leaders are telling me their challenges. And I'm like, oh, I can solve that. I can fix your problem. But none of them bought. Like no one said, hired me. So financially, we're dragging the bottom. And we got to where we had 10,000 left in our checking and savings combined.
Still no house.
Still no house. Still no cars. Like And that money, Laura and I were like, okay, that will pay our rent for the next 6 months. And if this business doesn't get off the ground in the next 6 months, then we have to eject, and, you know, and you've got to get a job. And I've never gotten a job in my life. I've always been an entrepreneur, you know? So I was like, get a job. I can't do that. I have to build something. I have to lead. I have to be in charge. I can't work for somebody. And so it was like, okay, we got a 6 month runway. But I knew that nothing was going to change in that 6 months to launch the business if I couldn't sell. So I was at a conference, sitting at lunch, and, you know, we're doing the 30-second elevator speech around the table. And the guy across from me said, I help coaches and consultants land 5- and 6-figure contracts. And I was like, holy smokes, that wasn't even 30 seconds, but I'm in. Like, if you can really do that, if you can deliver, then I have to hire you. And he said, well, you know, the down payment for my services is $10,000. And then it's going to be $3,000 a month for the next 6 months. So I talked it over with Lark as we make decisions together. And oh my goodness, the faith and the grit that woman has to let me take our accounts down to zero and turn a 6 month runway into a 0 month runway and give it to some guy that I met at a conference. And then I went and took out a year-long no interest business credit card so that I could put those 3,000 monthly payments on that card with no way to pay it. And 90 days later, I closed a contract for $105,000.
Wow. That is so intense, man.
Oh, my goodness. I was like sweating rocks. It was intense.
Real quick, touch on this for me. You said in passing, you know, Laura and I make decisions together. You guys have been married a long time, and did she know what she was signing up for when she married you?
No, but let me tell you one of the biggest mistakes that I made in the first 6 months of our marriage. So the flu swept through. I was still in school and she was working and supporting me, and flu swept through the town, and she was like literally on an IV vomiting up her toenails. She actually went home and stayed with her mom. Like, we're married, but she's so sick. She's like, I need my mom. So she went home and was staying with her mom to try to recover from this stomach virus. And I was driving through town and I saw a 1968 Ford Mustang parked out in front of somebody's yard with a for sale sign on it. And I love classic cars and sports cars. So I was like, I was pulled in, and they only wanted, get this, they wanted $2,200 for a 68 Mustang.
How long have you been married at that time?
6 months.
Okay.
And my wife's working, supporting me, you know. I got a part-time job like in the tutoring center. You know, she's supporting us. And I was like, we got $2,200 in our bank account. And so I drove to, this is how bad I was. I drove to her parents' house. I went, she was staying in her parents' bedroom, you know, because it had an attached bathroom where she could get back and forth because she's so sick. The lights are off. She's got like a wet cloth over her eyes. And I knelt down by the bed and I said, honey, I just saw a good deal on a car. And I'm wondering, could I buy this car? Would that be all right? Laura's like, woo, woo, woo. You know, she's moaning and she didn't hear a word I said. And I was like, well, I'm going to take that as a yes. And I.
Wow. You're such an optimist.
Oh, my goodness. I bought that car because, okay, so I'm a follower of Christ. I'm a believer, and that means everything to me, but I have to be a little bit self-critical of an attitude that a lot of Christian husbands have. That is, I need to make all the financial decisions. I need to be, you know, the leader of the house, which means I set the direction and I'm the final vote and all that. I really had that attitude towards money and marriage, and it blew up pretty big. I could tell you more stories, but what happened eventually is I realized Laura was better at money than I was. In fact, she was a lot better at money. So it was a little humbling for me to take my pride off and say, you're better at this. You need to manage it. Actually, you need to make some decisions. I may have some vision and strategy around money in the business or investments or things like that, but you are so much better at making decisions and managing it that I just can't, I'm going to do stupid stuff for the rest of my life if I don't pay attention to the wisdom that God put right there in my life partner. So that reframed our partnership in life and marriage and then in business as well.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah, tips to you younger guys out there, man, right there for sure. Oh my gosh. Well, back to risk, because it's just, I mean, the story of draining your account and placing a bet on a guy you just met. Let's assume that, you know, you've got a secure job and you're sort of standing on the edge looking to jump off and start your own business. What are some how would you describe the risk journey in doing that? And what would be some of the warnings that you would give?
Yeah. Wow. Well, first of all, the three core values in my business are risk, results, and relationships. And those are actually the business translations of three eternal core values of faith, hope, and love. To me, everything good that's happened in my life has happened on the other side of risk. I feel like, you know, in the Bible, it says without faith, it's impossible to please God. You know, faith is required in your walk with God. And I think in business, risk is the table stakes. Like if you're not willing to take that risk and step out there where there's not a safety net, then you're not going to see the returns and the blessings and the benefits and the profit in any kind of business venture. So I think recognizing that you can't avoid risk and succeed is the first step. But then, you know, not every risk is a good one. And for me, I'm way optimistic. You know, I always think it will work. I can always see the possibility. So I have to surround myself with people that have good judgment. I remember it wasn't even early, probably 10 years into our marriage. The two of us were in a counseling session. Nothing was wrong or broken. We just wanted to, you know, sharpen the saw. And we're in the room and the guy had done some assessments and he looked at my wife and he said, "You have good judgment." And he looked at me and he said, "And you're going to get it." It was like he could see that she had a quality of judgment and prudence that I didn't. Maybe I was teachable or I could learn it, but I needed to have advisors, and my wife is just one of those. She's the one I trust the most. But I have a business mentor I meet with every week who's 10 years ahead of me in business, very successful. I have a spiritual business mentor that I meet with once a month. And I have a business coach that I meet with every other week. All of these people I've solicited into my life and my experience to help me make those decisions when I have risks. because you know, otherwise I might just go gonzo and, you know, dive off the cliff and splat.
Right. No one wants to splat.
Nobody wants to splat, you know, but having those people helps me make kind of the evaluation of the risk and make better decisions. So you got to have both. You got to have the willingness to embrace the risk, knowing that all the blessings and good stuff are on the other side, but have some wisdom speaking into you so you take good risks.
Yeah, I think you're right, because naturally a visionary is not as fearful of the consequences as they probably should be, which is a real asset and a real liability at the same time. And surrounding yourself with people that have good judgment is, I mean, if, for example, my business partner, Lee Ellis, is one of those people that has good judgment, far more conservative than I am. But it creates this environment where there's this push pull all the time of what's next, but wait, kind of gas pedal, brake pedal type stuff going on. Which, you know, is really good. But I really love the way you described how you deal with your natural inclination towards risk, which is, you know, a weekly meeting with a mentor, a monthly meeting with a spiritual advisor, and then having a business coach. I would like to ask you what the difference is between a mentor and a coach, because I think those two words get crisscrossed sometimes. I'm not sure I could describe it, but I'd love for you to give your interpretation of the difference.
Yeah, and I think we have to acknowledge there's a lot of overlap between a mentor and a coach. So if I try to draw a super bright line, it may artificially make distinctions that aren't always there. But I would say a mentor to me it has a couple of differences. A mentor is bigger picture, or a coach might be more tactical. We have a problem to solve. We have an issue to overcome. We have a skill to gain, you know, mastery to acquire, and a coach is going to help you do that. Where a mentor is more bigger picture of where are you going with your life? Who are you becoming? What's the legacy that you're creating even right now? What's the impact that you're having? I also think a mentor should be drawing up your identity and your desires, drawing those up and out of you into expression. Whereas sometimes a coach needs to come from the outside and kick you in the butt. You know, they've got to get up in your grill a little bit more and confront you. Now, again, I'm drawing some distinctions that, you know, some people might say, well, my mentor gets up in my grill, or my coach helps me with the longer term life plan. There's a lot of overlap, but that would be the way I would distinguish them.
Yeah, that's a great distinction. And I'm curious, I want to go back to something we were talking about earlier, how you placed this bet on this guy that helped you close deals. I'm wondering if you could distill a few of the elements, maybe distill a few of the aha moments that you had that were the biggest game changers for you as it related to closing these deals, because you obviously had no problem getting these meetings, getting in front of these executives that had a long list of pain points that you saw obvious solutions to, or at least knew that you could help. What did this guy tell you that helped you so much?
There's two or three really key game changers for me. One is that there is no difference between coaching and selling. I thought I have to do the selling so that I can earn the right to do the coaching. But
the coaching as the product. In other words,
the coaching as the product.
Understood. Yeah. Okay, gotcha. Sorry.
Yeah. So if I'm selling my services as an executive coach,
understood,
then I've got to have this sales conversation and convince them and get them to sign a contract. And then I shift gears and I become a coach. And one of the things Chris helped me see is that the coaching starts, the sales conversation is a coaching conversation, because if they didn't have if they didn't have a problem that they needed a coach for, or let me say it another way, the problem that's causing them to need a coach is something they cannot overcome on their own. Otherwise, they would have already solved it. So in the sales conversation, I'm coaching them in the same approach, because the first change and decision they need to make is to hire me to help them do what they need to do and be their highest and best leadership self. So it's the same process. And if I can't help them have the insight and come to a decision point in a sales conversation, how do I ever think I would be able to change their behavior as a coach? Like, we're overcoming obstacles on day one. It's the same thing. So that helped me recognize it's not, I got to get good at this so that I can do this other thing that I'm already good at. It's the same process.
So real quick, so were you making the mistake of gating this coaching ninja skill that you had and just selling in those initial meetings? Is that the mistake you were making? And the epiphany was that you just wove in really good content and connection with these executives. I'm trying to understand the
Shift. Like, I need to withhold all the goods because you have to pay me to get the goods.
Gotcha. Yeah.
I'm going to be this fantastic coach once you hire me, and realizing, you know, I've had conversations with prospects that they said yes to an engagement at the end of the conversation, and it never felt like a sales conversation to them. And we'd get halfway through, you know, they'll ask me at the beginning, so tell me what you do. And I'm like, I'd rather show you. Would that be all right? So let's just talk about your business. And then I would coach them, and then they're like, oh, now I know what you do. And yes, can I hire you, because that was so effective. The other mindset shift I had to make was, you know, I think a lot of people in coaching and consulting specifically are motivated to help. We want to help other people. We want to help them reach their potential, be their best, and all of that. But in that sales conversation, you can't hug them. You have to punch them.
It's a little counterintuitive.
It is. And I felt like, oh, that's, you know, if other listeners are like me in that desire to please people, you know, and get other people's approval, then, you know, coaching can be a tempting field, because you know, you're coming alongside, and you have this deep connection, and you build this trust, and it feels like it can be very validating, when what you really need to be doing is helping them squarely face the pain and the obstacle that they don't want to look at, and see how they've helped create that situation. And that feels like it feels icky. It feels like, oh, we're diving into the yuck. But that's what you have to do. So, you know, that switch was big for me. And then ultimately realizing that sales is service, that I'm serving them. If they didn't hire me, they're going to keep suffering the pain and the problems and the obstacles. It serves them for me to help them get clarity on those things. And even if they don't hire me, I'm going to serve them in that conversation to create clarity they didn't have before. And I'm okay whether they say yes to me or not, because I fulfilled my purpose. I served them in that conversation, and I stayed in my integrity of who I am and what I do. And then I'm not worried about, you know, I've got to persuade them. They may not be the right client for me. I may not be the right solution for them. So those mindset shifts were pretty big game changer.
That's really great. Well, and I read that you were also really into helping teams, and you helped one executive team who had kind of a stagnant revenue for almost a decade, where they just weren't growing. Their business wasn't growing. They had, you can fact check me here, but I'm guessing they had just had a lot of baggage, a lot of disagreement, misalignment. They were just kind of spinning their wheels. And then you were able to come in, and within 18 months, they experienced a 20% uptick in their sales. I read a piece that was written about you, and I thought that was really interesting. What were some of the key steps that you took to get this team off High Center?
Yeah, so one of my maxims is, if you don't have mutual accountability, you don't have a team. A team is not, a team captain that has one-way accountability with each member of the team. A true team is, I'm not just accountable to whoever the boss or CEO is, but I'm accountable to my teammate, to the person next to me. That's a pretty massive shift that is simple to say, but a lot of leadership teams have one-way accountability. So the person in sales is not accountable to the person in operations, and they're not accountable to the person, leading HR or IT or marketing or whatever that is. Helping that team realize it's more, and helping the leader recognize, I have to actually push authority and accountability down to the team, because otherwise I'm the bottleneck. And if it fails, it's because I ran out of capacity. I couldn't run around and spin all those plates fast enough. There's not enough of me to go around, which is the problem a lot of founders and entrepreneurs have. And it feels very vulnerable to give up some of the control and push some decisions and some accountability down, so I'm not the one monitoring everybody. But that's another form of risk, right? That's a risky thing to do. But until you do it, people don't have ownership of what they're doing. And if they don't have ownership, you're never going to take care of something as well as when it's yours.
True. And, you've said before that CEO, coaching a CEO and coaching teams are two sides of one equation.
Yes.
Can you speak more to that? Because I often see, and even in my own business, we've done some 360 evaluations, and there's just a disconnect between the leadership and the team in many cases. And I'd just love to hear you speak on that.
Yes. So I do think of, the CEO or the president and their team as kind of two side on each side of an equal sign. They're two parts of the equation. At first, I thought I was gonna be an astronaut, and so I was a physics major.
Sorry, I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing with you right now. But that's cool.
Oh man, yeah, I was awesome. I was gonna fly into space. So I did physics and math and all of this stuff. And whatever in math, whatever you do to one side of the equation, you have to do the other. And you can literally do anything to an equation as long as you do it to both sides. But I see a lot of leaders that want to work on only one side. Either they're like, hey, just work with me and be my coach so that I can get better and I can be this awesome leader, and then my business is going to take off. Or other people are like, hey, I'm great, but my team's lousy. Can you come in and fix my team? But, whatever you do to one side of the equation, you have to do the other. If I can work with a CEO and the leadership team, then we can work on breaking down walls, building some trust, creating accountability on both sides of that. So the team realizes the leader is not invincible and invulnerable and unquestionable. That leader can lead the way in building trust by by being open, and acknowledging they do have weaknesses too. They have challenges. They're not good at everything. They need the team, and the leader can see that somebody's working with the team that's not him or her. Someone else can come in, because it's like with your kids. Sometimes they can't hear it from you. They've got to hear it from their friend's dad or from somebody else, because you've been telling them all along, but they can't hear that. Sometimes teams are the same way. They've heard it from the CEO or the president, and it's not getting through. But an outside party can come in and help them hear what they need to hear. The best things happen when you work both sides of the equation.
Right. Yeah. Well, and have you noticed any particular common blind spots that you see with most leaders? I mean, you touched on a few, like, mm-hmm. you know, learning to let go, right, of certain things that they're tight-fisted and controlled. Are there any other blind spots that are common that you see?
Yes. So I ask this question often. I say, if you had options, would you work for someone who didn't recognize your value? Hmm. And every time I ask that question, I get the same answer. Of course not. Yeah. If I had options, I would not work for someone who didn't recognize my value. So then you flip that around and say, do the people that work for you know that you recognize their value? And that's a different question from saying, do you value them? Because every leader is like, oh yeah, my people are my greatest asset. But the question is, do they know that you recognize their value? And then you ask that at the next level, what about my leadership team? Do the people that work for them know that they recognize their value? The reason it's simple, but the reason I bring that up as a blind spot is because we assume that people know what we're thinking. We assume that they know, well, don't they know I care for my employees? Don't they know I put my people first?
I told them that one time. They should know.
I told them. I think it. No, unless they feel that and know it, you will never get their best performance. And they will always be holding those options in the back of their head. They're looking, because if I have options, will I work for someone that doesn't recognize my value? Hmm. No, I won't. Or I'll be biding my time until the best option comes along, and then I'm gone. So you're not keeping me. You're not retaining me. You're also not getting my best performance today, because I'm not all in.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, you recently did. You were in the studio with Dr. Alan Pickering.
Yes.
And he wrote a book on assertiveness that I've not read yet, but it looks really fascinating. But the premise that, and you touched on it earlier, you were describing just this, you've got to get in people's grill sometimes in a leadership role. We call it the velvet hammer in our yes. company, where it's walk softly, carry a big stick, and just, but assertiveness, I think, can be misunderstood as just being mean. Can you speak to the impact and the importance of this? Because it sounds like, I'm just guessing, but it sounds like one of your shifts in your sales tactics back in the day was this assertiveness thing. Is that true?
It is. And I find that people value someone that will speak truth to them and help them see the truth. That truth is a priceless commodity. And a lot of leaders don't get honest feedback. Either they're not asking for it, or when they ask, people don't believe that they really want it. Hmm. So they don't give it. So being able to speak the truth, I think my challenge for assertiveness is different from the person that might struggle with being blunt and mean. I'm coming from the side of a people pleaser.
Yeah, nice guy.
Wanting approval, right. Wanting to be nice mm-hmm. and tactful.
Mm-hmm.
But I think whether you're coming from my side or whether you're coming from the mean side, the root might be the same. One of the elephants in the room of leadership is insecurity. And an insecure leader can show up as the abrasive, blunt, mean, tell it like it is, but leave carnage leader. Or an insecure leader can be the, I can't offend anybody. I need to make everybody happy and have their approval. You know, kind of like The Office. I've got my mug, world's best boss. I literally have that mug, by the way. But underneath that, right, is insecurity.
Yeah.
On The Office and the toxic leader and the people-pleasing leader, the root problem is the same. And they're looking for that insecurity need to be met, either by people need to fear and respect me or everybody needs to like me. But underneath, that insecurity keeps us from telling the truth, or it keeps us from speaking in kindness.
Hmm. That's fascinating. What are some of the symptoms that you see where the root, like what are some of the obvious signs of an insecure leader?
Breathing.
Good answer. I mean, it's a great answer because you're right. It's really a universal issue. Yeah. How does a leader sort of root out their insecurities? How do they find out, or how do we, I would say, since we're breathing here, how do we find out our insecurities and mitigate those? Because, I mean, you know it better than anybody. I mean, you've seen these teams suffer as a result of an insecure leader that doesn't know his insecurity. He's unaware of his insecurity. And I'm also guessing that part of your role is to help leaders identify their insecurities and meet them face to face and work with them. How do you go about doing that? Because nobody likes to look themselves in the mirror very long. Yeah. I know that for sure. I've checked.
Yeah. You know, I'll say two things about that. One is rooting out those insecurities requires deep work. I really honestly don't know any other way to get into it without doing deep work. And that deep work is going to require reflection, meditation. It's going to require going places inside that we don't go because we're busy, or if we ever creep to the threshold of it, it's really scary down there in the basement and we just don't want to go there, but it requires deep work. And if somebody's not willing to be reflective and go deep, they're not going to root it out. And the second thing I'll say is we will never face our insecurities without a context of safety. And really, I think that's human nature. Like, you won't get naked if it's not safe. Mm. And that plays out on teams. Like, psychological safety was the one factor. Google studied 180 teams across their company, and they measured everything. I mean, they took people's temperature and they analyzed and assessed, like, what makes a high performance team. And what they came up with, number one, was teams that had psychological safety were high performance. And all the other things they thought would predict it don't. Psychological safety is key. Well, how does the leader get psychological safety? Because you can't have that at work. At least, like, you know, you can't take off your clothes and walk around naked at work because people lose confidence and, like, things fall apart. It's like, oh, no, the leader doesn't have – I mean, leader needs to have some level of vulnerability, but they're not going to do their deep work and root out their insecurity with their team and their company. For me, that place of absolute safety and security, it is in my faith. It's recognizing that I'm completely loved apart from anything that I do, without any productivity or success or getting anything right or being a genius or any of that, that just screwed up, messed up me is deeply loved. And that's unchangeable. I mean, it's easy to say those words, but for me, when I have been able to accept that and receive it, that creates that safe environment where I can actually do the deep work. So doing the deep work and finding your safe environment. And, you know, I'm sure there's listeners, you know, to this podcast that are all across the spectrum of faith. And that's great. Wherever you are, I have no criticism for that. But you've got to find your place of safety and security that allows you to do the deep work so that you don't, you know, live out a toxic on one hand or a limp leadership on the other hand. It just has to be done.
Yeah, it's hard work. It really is. It's hard work. And, you know, my as you call it, deep work, sort of that journey for me, you know, it started less than a decade ago. And most of it was foisted on me through circumstance, just like a complete threshold of, you know, and it required, it required a lot of hard work and a lot of money. Like, it was expensive and took forever, but you know, my team look a little different than yours with the way you described it. You know, I had a therapist and a, you know, I was involved with, John Townsend and the Townsend's Leadership Group.
Yes.
Very transformative for me. And then, had various mentors and spiritual directors along the way to help me. But, you know, the one outcome of all of that is that it made me a better, more connectable leader because I did so much heavy lifting, you know, it just improved so much. It's, you know, anyone that works with me, you know, for that, during that period knows they saw it. They saw the evolution and the change. And that's one of the missions behind this podcast is just to, you know, just to highlight that, highlight the fact that it requires that heavy lifting and that, as you call it, deep work, to be effective and to be a good leader and really to be happy, you know, and to experience joy and all these things. And I love the way you described how your faith in God is an integral part of all that. Well, we are unfortunately running low on time, Dr. Shiro, and I wanted to, but I want to like finish up the podcast just for fun with some rapid fire questions. And what does the first hour of your day look like? And it's okay to get specific.
Yeah. So I, first hour of my day is spent with the counselor, and that's the Holy Spirit to me. Ideally, I take my camping chair. Half mile from me is a little creek behind our house in a greenbelt. And right off the jogging trail, you can squeeze through the bushes and sit right by the creek, and you don't even know you're in DFW.
Wow.
And I sit there in my camp chair with my thermos of coffee and my journal and my Bible, and that is the best start to my day.
That sounds dreamy. I'm going to come find your spot.
There's green spaces that we don't use. And like, this is literally, I don't have to go to the woods or rent a VRBO or a cabin or like, it's literally behind my house.
Yeah.
I live in North Richland Hills in the middle of urban jungle.
Good for you. What books do you recommend most to your clients most consistently?
So Lynn Cioni's Five Dysfunctions of a Team, just so foundational.
Yeah, it's awesome.
That's a key one. You know, a lot of leaders I work with don't feel like they have time to read, and they'd rather get it in short snippets. So I draw from a lot of different books. So I rarely just put a book in somebody's hand because a lot of them are such doers, they won't take time to do it. But Lynn Cioni's book is a good one.
That's a good one. We'll link it in the show notes. So you and I both picked some really good wives, right? We really are winners in that arena. What would you tell What advice would you give a young man as he's looking for a wife?
Well, first things, leave your phone in the car.
I love it. don't take pictures of your food. No selfies on the date. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Look into her eyes. Like, give her your full attention. And you know, if a connection happens, then you'll feel it. But if you're not even giving the opportunity for a deep connection to happen because you're so distracted, how are you even going to find that person? If you don't put away the distractions. Plus, I believe that, you know, women and men too, but want to be attended to and to have that value drawn out. So be the kind of guy that draws out the value and the beauty of the woman you're with.
Great one. I love it.
That's my quick rapid fire answer.
You betcha. What is your, where do you get your news? How do you consume the news? I have such a struggle with this, and I ask everybody on the podcast, hey, how do you get your news? Because I can't ever find any good news.
I'm a news addict.
Oh, good. Okay. Tell me how you do it.
When I was in high school, I would go to the school library and read Newsweek, Time, and U.S. News and World Report from cover to cover every week. That's how I did it in high school. I started as a news junkie back then. Today, my go-to, even though I don't love it, my go-to is Google News, and I start from there. But I drill into there's a little button of like expand the story or see more sources, because I don't always like the news sources they put front and center. There's a graphic, and some people may have seen it, but it ranks every news source across the spectrum, liberal to conservative, or, you know, what bias are they bringing? Because I think today we realize everybody's got a bias.
Yes.
Left or right, everybody's got one. So I look at that spectrum, I ignore the fringes, and I try to get some stuff on either side of the middle. You know, I've been toying with subscribing to the Wall Street Journal because I think it's the last bastion of unbiased news, but it's dang expensive.
So, that's funny.
Yeah.
You have to ask your wife.
I don't want to plunk down my money.
Yeah. So if you had to, this is the last one. If you had to teach a course at TCU this fall, what would be the subject?
I would do a self-development course, lead yourself first and self-awareness. So that's what it would be. You got to know yourself before anything good's going to happen.
Amen, brother. I'm with you on that. Well, how do people get in contact with you, Philip?
So I'm happy for people to have my cell phone and text me, 817-726-2000.
There you go. Easy enough.
and my, you know, email, if they want to have a long conversation. So drshiro@mastermindsleadership.com.
Awesome. Okay. Well, Philip, this has been such a blast. I really appreciate you coming on the show. Do you have any parting thoughts?
I love what you're doing and helping people know it's going to be a challenge and rise to it. The true grit, press through the struggle.
Yeah, that's it, man. Well, you've really given some serious wisdom today, Dr. Shiro, and for that, we are thankful. You have a good one.
Thanks, Craig. Bye-bye.
Well, folks, that wraps up our show for this week. If you found this interview helpful and would like to get pearls of wisdom that I've gathered along the way, go to truegritpodcast.com and subscribe to the True Grit blog. You will get short, helpful emails written by yours truly. Included in these posts, you will also get the show notes with links to books, articles, and other cool things I run across. Thanks as always for listening to the True Grit Podcast, where we believe that personal growth and helping each other solve important problems is the best way to make the world a better place. And don't forget, building a company and a life of meaning takes true grit.